I'm sure we've heard the saying, come up in our first PowerPoint, the saying of the Medes and the Persians. It's like trying to change the law of the Medes and the Persians. They weren't big on change. Or in Ireland, it's more appropriate to talk about Murphy's Law. It can't be done. We've tried before. It can't be done. But there's another quote of Hudson Taylor's. I think it's in the third slide. We had it last week, but it's worth repeating again because this is actually what we see happening in this chapter. Hudson Taylor once said, "It is possible to move men, even Persian kings. It is possible to move men through God by prayer alone." That's what he believed when he went to China to be a missionary. As mere humans, we need to know our limitations, what we can do and what we can't do. And I cannot change your heart, but God can. And though Persian kings and Medes were famous for no change, we're going to see the God of heaven, the King of Kings, move the heart of a pagan king. Well, Nehemiah's been praying and thinking and planning for a tough job in Jerusalem. We left him last week at the end of chapter 1. When he pleads, O Lord, verse 11, "Let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant, and to the prayer your servant of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the sight of this man." The success Nehemiah was looking for was not his own prestige and popularity, but for the work of God done in the way of God, for the glory of God. And when you come to chapter 2, verse 1, it's now the month of Nisan. There's roughly here between 3 to 5 months. So this is not, Nehemiah's not just popped a lot of things out of his head in the spur of the moment. He's been praying. Was he praying all the time with his eyes closed and his knees bowed? Probably not. He could have been walking around. He could have been writing things. He could have been reflecting. In one sense, it was praying without ceasing. But up to this point, there's been no answer. 5 months. How was he ever going to just even get around a Persian king? How was he ever going to leave this significant position that he had as the cupbearer to the king? He was trusted. He was a trusted advisor. He was a man of character. And amazingly, he was a Jew, and a Persian king has him in his winter palace. And so when you come to chapter 2, verse 1, months have passed. Until one particular morning, it might have been one of those blue Monday morning blues, the Monday morning blues that come upon us. Artaxerxes is still on the throne. Nehemiah is still the cupbearer, and he's still going around drinking the wine, testing the wine, and eating the food, and doing what he was supposed to do. But his heart is somewhere else. His heart's somewhere else. It's back in Jerusalem, because he's asked his friends in chapter 1, the opening verses, what's happening in Jerusalem? What's happening with God's work? How are God's people doing? Was it ever going to happen? Well, we're about to see who God is, who he is, what he does, how he does it. And remember, as I said last week, and we need to remind ourselves of this, Nehemiah is all about God. The whole Bible is about God. It's not about us. It's not about Nehemiah. God uses an ordinary man by his grace to do his work, his way, for his glory. So Nehemiah is just an instrument. But God had gifted him and enabled him. We'll see God moving in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform, working behind the scenes. Now, there's a number of words that we have that will give us an overview of this chapter, and they come up in the next. There they are. You think he's going to be pretty fast today? He can go through those easy. Well, this will help us, because the time has come now. And Nehemiah, unknown to him even, is about to ask permission to go to where his heart lies, to God's people. The walls are broken down. The gates are burned with fire. They're completely in despair. Things are about to change. Up until now, he's kept his emotions in control. We all have breaking points, don't we? The accumulation of cares and concerns and distresses. And this day, 5 months since he'd heard the news, he's finding it hard to perform his tasks. You know what it's like when you're trying to perform your task and your mind and your heart is elsewhere. Prayer has gone unanswered. Maybe it was one of those Mondays. "Why is your face so sad? You are not sick," says the king. And Nehemiah himself says, "I had not been sad in his presence," at the end of verse 2. "The king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick?'" It wasn't good to be sad in the king's presence. He'd never been sad in the king's presence before. But now he is. And you know, sometimes it's like that for you and for me, isn't it? We can put on a brave face. We can disguise what's really happening inside us. We don't give away what's going on inside our hearts sometimes. Perhaps most times. Perhaps all times. And like Nehemiah, all kinds of things are going on in any group of people gathered together. Behind the mask, behind the smile, maybe a broken heart. A weeping heart, a torn heart, an empty heart. Who really knows? Until the mask slips. And before the king of Persia, the mask slips. And I wonder if we realize at times, how fragile people like us can really be. It's a wonderful story, William Cowper. The Americans call him William Cooper. We call him William Cowper. But it is a remarkable story of great anguish and yet great grace. The pressures, the deep disappointments, the hurts, the despair, all that goes on, we can be smiling. And inside of us, like Nehemiah, there's a great storm raging. Our emotions are running amok. Unseen by all around us, groaning, screaming on the inside. And we try to appear well in public. Well, the king noticed there was something different about Nehemiah. And it wasn't because he was sick. But his face gave away something else. The king's diagnosis was this. "This is nothing but sadness of heart." That was it. And more than that, the God of heaven saw Nehemiah's sadness of heart. Here's where we identify with Nehemiah. He's a real man. He lives where you and I live, with all the issues of life. And notice what he says, "And I was very much afraid." We identify with him there, don't we? He's sad. But he's fearful. And he says to the king, "Why should my heart not be sad?" "Then I was very much afraid," he said. "I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city
And the place of my father's graves lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire. Why should I not be sad? God's name, God's work, God's glory has been trampled in the streets. That's what moved him. And then the king said to me, "What are you requesting? What is it you ask for?" Imagine, 5 months. A Persian king. The God of heaven steps in. He plants his footsteps right in the winter palace of a Persian king. And he's going to move his heart. And he's going to change the course of Nehemiah's life. Friends, God does that today in the world, in people's lives. So I prayed to the God of heaven. He didn't say, "Excuse me, King, can I have 10 minutes to go to the prayer room?" No, he prayed to the God of heaven. It's a narrow prayer, or some described as a prayerogram. There and then. Oh, dangerous to be sad in the king's presence. He prays. He spoke with heaven's king before any earthly king. He poured out his heart to heaven's king before he spoke them to Artaxerxes, the king of Persia. Because it's heaven's king that makes the difference, isn't it? That can see us in the mess that we're in and lift us by his grace. You see, for prayer for Nehemiah, you read his prayer, chapter 1, that we had last week. Prayer for Nehemiah wasn't something that was supplemented, added on to his work life. And when he had a minute or two, he prayed to God. It was absolutely fundamental. Keep reading that little article, those little articles by J.C. Ryle on Do You Pray in the Bulletin. Worth reading. But here he is. Prayer for Nehemiah is fundamental so that when an emergency comes, he can shoot up a prayer to God. I pray to the God of heaven. He's looking and depending on heaven's king. And he begins now to outline what he requests, if it pleases the king. Now, he hasn't just suddenly there and then come to him. God can do that. But you've got to imagine, you've got to think, over the period of months, he's been thinking about Jerusalem. He's been thinking about the broken walls and the broken people and the broken hearts. And so he says, if it pleases the king, he makes a number of requests. Let him send me to the city of Judah so that I can rebuild it. So he's not beating about the bush. This is what I want to do. That's where I want to go. And the king with the queen sitting beside him, surprisingly, maybe he says, how long are you going to be gone? And it pleased the king to send me. So I set a time. This is a Persian king. Nothing changes in Persia. But heaven's king. Read Proverbs 21:1. It is heaven's king who turns the hearts of earthly kings. Like a watercourse, like, you know, the way the stream goes. That is God that does that. We need to see that God is big and people are small. We've got it the other way around. We've got this big view of people and a small view of God. It's all the wrong way around. God is big. We are small. We're insignificant. So I said to the king, he gets bolder, doesn't he, as he goes on? He asks for letters of request for safe passage. He's going to build a wall. He's going to put up some gates. He's going to need wood. He's going to need mortar. He's going to need stones. So he gets a requisition form, whatever, for give me some building supplies to do the job. So when he gets there, those are saying, "Well, who are you? Here's the letter. Here's King of Persia, stamped and all, for safe passage. For building material, for permission to build the wall that had lain in ruins for years. This is a work of God." This is heaven's king granting his requests. And, well, some might say, oh, well, he must have got Artaxerxes on a good day. He must have been in a good mood. Or maybe he was just so sorry for Nehemiah that he couldn't help doing it. No. What does Nehemiah say? Because the request is granted. What does Nehemiah say? Verse 8. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. Do you see that? God moving in mysterious ways. So, where are we at so far? Chapter 1, he hears the destruction of Jerusalem. There's this reaction where he weeps and he prays and he fasts. And then there's his counteraction where he makes confession of sin to God and includes himself in that in chapter 1. And now here we are, we're on the verge. He's on his way to Jerusalem, which would have taken some time, I imagine. He's going there. And now we have Nehemiah going into action. But notice what he does when he gets in Jerusalem. Notice what he does. We're told that I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days. Now, we're not told why. Was he in further prayer or reflection? Possibly. Maybe he was just exhausted. It's a long way, hundreds of miles. So you can imagine that. Maybe he's just taking time to get alone with God again. He's not going right into it, but 3 days. He doesn't rush into action. He doesn't hit the road running. He takes a breather. But notice, as he inspects the wall, as he examines the wall in verses 11 to 16, you'll notice some aspects of the way that he went about that. He did it quietly for a start. He didn't tell anybody what he was doing or what God had put in his heart. There's no fanfare. There's no big posting on Facebook event. Nehemiah, the new governor's coming to Jerusalem. None of that. There's no press conference. There's no TV coverage. There's no interviews. He doesn't call a press conference. He's not going to tell the people how he's going to make Jerusalem great again. He's alone with God. And he sets about his reconnaissance mission, doesn't he? He gets on a horseback and he goes round the walls, massive walls. You can maybe get a view of that in your back of your Bible. Jane's been there recently and seen that. You can talk to her. An amazing job. The walls are broken down. The gates are burned with fire. The people are in great despair. And he does his reconnaissance mission. Why does he do that? He wants to gather all the facts. He wants to see the potential problems. He could only get a certain distance around and had to turn around and come back again. But he got enough to know the picture. And often we want to get everything done and sorted. We want to implement. We had our refreshing vision the other night and we're thinking through. And the key thing is let's get on and implement. But Nehemiah takes time to see, says Matthew Henry, what is amiss before we can make amends. That, Jesus said that. Count the cost. So he does it quietly. He does it secretly by night. He takes a few men with him. Hasn't told anyone what God has put in his heart. But he does it methodically, logically, thoroughly. Because he's gathering information to bring to the people. He wants to know how bad things really are. He wants to probe and examine. He wants to, before he can say anything, he wants to count the cost, just as Jesus later taught in the Gospels. He's been praying, thinking, planning, gathering facts, establishing what it will mean and what it will be like. And he wants to bring God's truth to bear in the hearts of those that he's going to encourage to rise up and build. He's an excellent model of godly leadership. He obviously had great skills and abilities, but he was a humble
servant of God, concerned to want to do God's work, God's way, for God's glory and not his own. And so he's prayerfully dependent on God. And of course, he had come to seek the welfare of Jerusalem. And not everybody was happy about that. Do you see this? For the want of a better term, this unholy trinity in verse 10. When Sanballat, the Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite official, heard about it. And then later on, there's Gershom, verse 19, we'll come to later. This unholy trinity. Why are they upset about it? Because they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. That someone was concerned about the work of God enough that they'd come. They're like the three-man committee who was charged by the church to, you might have heard this story, to see about a new church building. And so they eventually got around to a fourfold resolution, which is as follows. We will build a new church building. Two, the new building will be on the site of the old building. Three, the material of the old building will be used in the construction of the new building. And we will continue to use the old building until the new building's complete. It's a bit like that, isn't it? That happens in churches, believe you me. Believe you me. Whether it's the colour of the curtains or the cutlery, it's all sorts of nonsense that goes on. Well, why would Nehemiah want to even be bothered? He's had a cushy job and he's a cushy job with the king back in Persia. Why would he want the hassle of people like Sanballat and Tobiah? And in fact, they keep popping up all the way along. But the Christian life's like that. Why would he bother? Because heaven's king put it in his heart. I told you a story some time ago, I think, about a man, well, he's 75, but he, for nearly 50 years he had worked with young men in the troubled part. I know Londonderry was the second largest city in Northern Ireland. 30 years of bombing, shooting, all kinds of violence going on. This man, for 30 years of those 50 years, he had numerous boys went through his, as it was called, Bible class then. T.S. Mooney. He was a bit of a character. And somebody said to him, why would you bother? These yobs are on the street. Why would you bother? What's your purpose in doing that? Do you remember his answer? He said, I do it because I believe that that's the work God has called me to do. And my purpose, here's his purpose. My purpose is to see that every young man will have a Bible in his hand, the Savior in his heart, and a purpose worth living for. That's why I do it. That's why I do it. So, there's his inspection. And that brings us to the third thing, motivation. Well, imagine how difficult it's going to be to motivate people like this. The walls have been down for decades. It lay all around them. They'd heard rumors of rebuilding before, but nothing's come of it. The extent of the destruction's overwhelming. They had a history of defeat, first with the Babylonians, 70 years captivity, now with the Persians. Imagine the deep discouragement. Well, how's Nehemiah going to motivate a bunch of people like that? Meanwhile, these three unholy opposers on the outside, dealing with them, how's it all going to work out? Well, look, how does he motivate them? Does he name and shame? No, he doesn't. Does he pour more guilt upon them? No, he doesn't do that either. He doesn't tell them to get their act together, what a terrible witness you've been. He didn't berate them. He didn't react out of frustration. Because you see, God has put something in his heart. And he's prayerfully dependent on God. He does three things to motivate them. He identifies himself with them. He challenges them. And he informs them with facts. Look at what he says. when he comes to speak to these people. Then I said to him, verse 17 and 18, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates are burned with fire. Do you see what he's doing? You see the trouble we are in. Do you remember in chapter 1? He says, we and I and my father's house have sinned. He's identifying with them. He's one of them. He's not above them. He's beside them. He's shoulder to shoulder with them. And the problem was they didn't see the trouble they were in. You know, when you have teenagers in your house and you go to their room and you know that stage of life where it's, look at the mess of this place. And they don't see the mess. They think it's cool. It looks really good like that. You don't move that, those smelly socks for a week. It's there's something good about it. And we can be like that in our lives, in our minds, in our hearts. We don't see the trouble we're in. It's a mess. He identifies them, but he challenges them. Come, let us build. You see the trouble we are in. So that we'll no longer be in disgrace, he says. And then he informs them. You can imagine this scene. He's trying to motivate these people. He's informed them with facts. He's given them clear information. It's not about his great abilities. It's about his great God. I told them about the gracious hand of God upon me, verse 18. And what the king said to me. It's about his God. It's about God working his way for his glory. He doesn't make himself significant. He said, oh, you know, I had this great idea and so I came to Jerusalem and I thought it all out. And No. He says, the good hand of God was upon me. He's not significant. God's significant. I told him of the hand of my God upon me for good. This is no vague spiritual comment, unable to be substantiated. Well, the Lord told me, no, he actually can show. This has been upon his heart. This is God's doing. Because then he talks not only about what God has done, but the words of the king. A Persian king. I told him what he said to me. Imagine them. Imagine this bunch of people in Jerusalem listening to him. He's got letters from the king. He said that God's hand's been upon him. He's not saying anything about himself and he's going to make Jerusalem great again. He's telling them facts. You can imagine them questioning him. Well, Nehemiah, what did he say? Well, he gives them factual information. Well, I was cupbearer to the king. Some friends came from Jerusalem, and I asked them, and I was concerned, and I was deeply saddened and deeply grieved at the work of God, the name of God, the glory of God, as in the state it's in. And I prayed. I confessed my sin to God. And then one day, the king saw that I was sad, very sad. What did you say? Well, I was very much afraid. What happened then? Well, I prayed to the God of heaven. Right there? What? What? Did you go away to the prayer room? Did you excuse it? No. Right there then. I prayed to the God of heaven. What happened then, Nehemiah? Well, the king said, what do you want? What do you want? Nehemiah is not like some of us. When God asks, what do we want? We don't know. It's so vague. He knew what he wanted. God's work, God's way, God's glory. I prayed to the God of heaven. Well, what do you want? Well, I said, if it pleases the king, could you let me go to Jerusalem for a while? I want to build a wall. And he says, how long will you be gone? What? He said that to you.
Leave a cushy job like that. Why would you come here with a cushy job like that? What did you say? I gave him a time frame and I asked for letters of safety and I asked for letters of provision. And on top of that, he sent extras with me. And the king granted me my requests. A Persian king? He must have been sick. He must have been sorry for you. He must have been in a good mood. No, it was because of the good hand of my God and your God and my God that was upon me. Heaven's king, turned the heart of a godless king. And he responded by providing a safe passage and all that we'll need for the work. You see, it's the result of prayerfulness, but it's the result of information. Nehemiah is affirmed in this. God has moved in a mysterious way. Now notice their response. Well over a decade, the mess, the broken walls, the broken gates, the discouragement of the heart. What do they say? Let us rise up and rebuild. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. The first time in over a decade and longer, the brickies were going to be on the wall. The joiners were going to be in the timber yard. And whatever else was needed, it was going to happen. Motivated by the good hand of God and clear, actual information. And as we'll see next week, he gets this gathering of defeated, discouraged people. And on the wall they go. That's for next week. You know, there was a turning point in the Second World War. Winston Churchill was the wartime prime minister. Chamberlain said, you know, there was going to be peace. Well, war broke out. And part of Churchill's speech was, you ask, what is our policy? I say it's to wage war by land and sea and air, war with all our might and with all the strength God has given us, and to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer it in one word, victory. Victory at all costs, victory in spite of all terrors, victory however long and hard the road may be, for without victory there is no survival. Come then, let us go forward together with our united strength. And then a few weeks later he made the great speech, we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them, and on he goes. Those of you who are old enough to remember Dad's Army, who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Hitler? If you think we're on the run, we're the boys who'll stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. Because who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Hitler? If you think old England's done. Churchill motivated a nation. Mr. Brown goes off to town on the 8/21. But he comes home each evening and he's ready with his gun. That's what moved the nation. But this is God moving the heart. The Home Guard, I didn't think they had any bullets or they could do anything, but you know, they looked impressive. Every person was motivated for the work that was to be done. And so they rise up and build. But you'll notice, and we'll come to it again briefly, the opposition. This unholy trinity appears again. President Trump's not the first to have people opposed to the building of a wall. Here it is here, right in the Old Testament. Sanballat, a Babylonian perhaps, what do you call the other? Tobiah, an Ammonite, and Gershom, an Arab. They had no part in this work. And you see, Nehemiah knew that not everybody would be for him. Not everybody would be happy with what he's going to do. But you know, there's certain oppositions and principalities and powers that are not flesh and blood.
Thomas Brooks, the old Puritan, said, he said, where God is likely to gain most and Satan is likely to lose most, there Satan and his instruments will stir and rage most. It's true, isn't it? We heard the other Saturday night, persecution of Christians in all parts of the world. There's a great opposer. Persecution, false accusations, slander, ridicule. You know, at the end of the day, by God's grace, they can be the very things that drive us into the arms of our King and our God. And if they do that, it's not that all criticism is wrong, by the way. There's a place for constructive criticism. There's a manner in which it can be given. But Nehemiah, he's going to face these guys again. And notice how he responds. He responds with a strong affirmation. Do you see it there? He clearly responds, then I replied to them, the God of heaven, heaven's King, will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. We will do it. Not because of how great we are. We know our limitations. But our God is for us and not against us. And you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. And you know, there's one greater than Nehemiah that has come to seek the welfare of God's people. It's King Jesus. And he comes into the brokenness that sin has brought upon the world. He comes as the second Adam for the first Adam field. And he's come with righteousness and with truth and with hope and with salvation and with the hope of a resurrection. And he's got that big plan that we see at the end there in the book of Revelation in chapter 7 and elsewhere. He has come to seek our welfare. And friends, you and I are partners in the building of Christ's church, wherever that is, in this little corner of his purposes and his plans. And you and I live in a culture where everything around us, and even within some churches, where everything's being redefined and watered down, whether it's redefining marriage, abortion, euthanasia, political correctness, it's all going on around us, and we are called as God's people to live in the midst of that as living stones, as a countercultural message to the world that we are not to be like that, we're to be like this. Not because we're anything better, we can't do it on our own, we need God. So, like Nehemiah, we need to know our limitations and God's strength. Let me leave you with three questions to ponder as we wrap up. As you read this chapter, keep reading through Nehemiah. Keep thinking about it. I wonder if you were able and to write down at some point what the greatest longing of your heart would be. If it were to be realized and answered, what would it be for you? What would it be for me? Would it be God's work, God's way for God's glory? Would it be, Lord, let your kingdom come. Let it come in Engadine Kong. Let it come in Engadine community. Let it come. That's the longing of our hearts. Would it cause us to say, God's cause is the longing of my heart. Those in my family, my son, my daughter, my wife, my husband, my friend, my neighbor, the longing of my heart is to see you, Lord, come and work in their lives, turn their hearts. Only you can do that, Lord. And I'm asking you to do it, pleading with you to do it. Would that be your longing? Second question, if you were to write the story of your life up to this point, and all the experiences you've gone through, and there's a fair wide range of ages here. Not just the high points,
the good points, the glory points, but the valley points, the lonely times, the wit's end corner times, the trying times, the overwhelming times, the times of defeat, the times of emptiness. Would you, could you say, the good hand of the Lord was upon me? Could I? I hope I could. Though some days I'm not sure. I hope I could. I know I should. But you know, because his hand is upon me, one day I know I will. And so do you if you're a believer. And last question. What is it that you, or I, or we, us, are asking and trusting God to do that cannot be achieved in our own strength? Do you remember Monday night, I just shared a little bit of the feeding of the 5,000. And Jesus said to the disciples, well, look, you feed them. We've got nothing. We can't do that. And there's this wee boy with a few loaves and fishes. And so Jesus says, well, bring them. And the disciples say, but what are these among so many? Here we are, we're few in number. And look at the need. How are we ever going to do it? And they made the point that the miracle was not that the wee boy was so kind and ready to offer his lunch and save the day for Jesus. The miracle was that God should use the wee boy's lunch. And the miracle's not that Nehemiah has traveled 800 miles to seek the welfare of Jerusalem and leave a cushy job. The miracle is that God would use Nehemiah. That the God of heaven, who needs no one, would use Nehemiah in the great task. And friends, the miracle at Engadine Congregational Church and every other church in our suburb, in our community, in our country, in our world, is not that we would give ourselves up to service of heaven's King, but that he would give us any part in his work and in his kingdom. And we should be eternally grateful that he has. The God who spoke the world into existence takes a wee boy's lunch, takes your gift, my gift, your brokenness and my brokenness. The God of the universe should ever choose to use the likes of us because we stumble and we fall and we feel. We are promise breakers, not promise keepers. But God is the great promise keeper. He is the King of heaven who says, I'm going to give you a part in my work to do it my way for my glory. As I close, when our kids were small, we taught them a few songs, but one was, my God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there is nothing my God cannot do. The mountains are his. The valleys are his. The stars are his handiwork too. Maybe we can learn this for next week for the kids. It's a great song. Jenna's not here because I can say it, but she used to go around cool supermarkets singing it. And the other one, the best book to read is the Bible. If you read it every day, it'll help you on your way. Well, this is good theology. This is not a two-year-old song. This is for every Christian. Because our God is so big. He is so mighty. He is able. We're not building a wall, but we are living stones being built up in the work of God. And we trust that God will put that in the heart of every church member in this place. For he is strong and mighty. There is nothing he cannot do. After all, he's chosen to use people like us. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your scriptures. Thank you for the life of Nehemiah. Thank you for every evidence in our own lives of your mighty hand at work, weaving, planning, contributing, preventing, bringing to pass your good and perfect will. May we know your good hand upon us for good and for your glory. Amen.